All right, folks, come on in. We'll get started with our evening Bible hour, or whatever we want to call it. This is where the elect hang out on Sunday nights. Okay, well, like I said this morning, Chris is not here, so he gave me the music to do, and he planned this morning, and he said for me to plan the evening. So here we are. Well, don't compare. What he planned was better. We're going to do what we have here. We're actually going to stay on a theme. I thought it would be appropriate to kind of stay within sort of the same thing. And so tonight we're going to sing about Christ being our Redeemer and our Savior. So we're going to kind of stay within that theme. So yeah, if you want to stand for the first song, we're going to do number 196, and then we'll sit for a few, and then we'll finish off with some songs. So number 196, I Will Glory in My Redeemer. I will glory in my Redeemer, whose priceless blood has ransomed me. Mine was the sin that drove the bitter nails and hung him on that judgment tree. I will glory in my Redeemer, who crushed the have a seat, and while you're having a seat, go ahead and turn over to 201, and we'll sing the song, There Is a Redeemer.
There is a Redeemer, Jesus, God's own Son. Spirit till the work on earth is done.
Turn over to 209, and we'll sing Rock of Ages, all four verses. Turn one over to number 210, and we will sing, "I Will Sing of My Redeemer." And this is, you'll see, you'll recognize the tune really quick because it's Jesus, What a Friend for Sinners, but different words.
In His boundless love and mercy.
Okay, one more. We'll go back to 185. We'll sing a real familiar one. Go ahead and stand for this last one. Number 185. Here's love.
Thanks, Lefty. You want to explain to us what happened there, or are you too embarrassed? A little volleyball injury with the kids Wednesday?
Soccer.
Oh, okay. Well, that's fair. Volleyball, we were going to have to make fun of you, but soccer, that's legitimate. All right, open your Bibles with me tonight, if you will, to Mark chapter 9. If you'll remember, we are looking at Mark chapter 9, verses 30 through 50 as a discipleship curriculum. Mark presents us with a kind of a medley on discipleship, a string of lessons on the meaning and cost and value of following Jesus. And so we've called this section Discipleship 101, and tonight we've come to lesson number 2. Follow along as I read, just looking at verses 33 through 37. Let me start in verse 30, though, just to remind us of the context. From there they went out and began to go through Galilee, and he did not want anyone to know about it, for he was teaching his disciples and telling them, The Son of Man is to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. And when he has been killed, he will rise 3 days later. But they did not understand this statement, and they were afraid to ask him. They came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he began to question them, "What were you discussing on the way?" But they kept silent, for on the way they had discussed with one another which of them was the greatest. Sitting down, he called the 12 and said to them, "If anyone wants to be first, he shall be last of all and servant of all." Taking a child, he set him before them, and taking him in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever receives one child like this in my name receives me, and whoever receives me does not receive me, but him who sent me." This is a lesson on greatness. What does it mean to be great? Who is the greatest in the kingdom of God? And I suppose it's fitting, and in importance, this lesson is second only to the previous one on the gospel. All disciples of Jesus must learn and understand the gospel, obviously, but second to that, all disciples must learn the principles Jesus teaches here about true greatness. And as we'll see, the disciples were as slow to learn lesson two as they were lesson one. Notice, first of all, though, their preoccupation with greatness. And as quick as we might be to criticize them for that, we should be honest and recognize that we have kind of the same preoccupation. We even have a term for it now in our culture. What is it? GOAT. Right? What does GOAT stand for? Greatest of all time. And there's a GOAT for every conceivable field, right? There's the greatest of all time country and Western singer. There's the greatest of all time president. There's the greatest of all time basketball or football or soccer or hockey or golf player. There's the greatest of all time civil rights advocate, greatest of all time comedian. You name it. Everything. Nobody wants to be the worst of all time. True? Being great, or at least being good at something, is a natural and common ambition that we all share. At least at some point in our life, we had that ambition. We aspire to greatness. We want to excel. We want to succeed. We want to be recognized by our peers as outstanding in our field, whatever field that may be. Michael Jordan certainly didn't become the greatest of all time by pursuing mediocrity. To be great at something, at anything, you have to be driven, you have to be disciplined, you have to be determined. And there's nothing wrong with that, is the point. In fact, we idolize goats because we recognize how hard they've worked to become that. It didn't just happen. And even as disciples of Jesus, as Christians, as members of his church, we don't want to be bad ones. We don't want to be crummy Christians, crummy church members. We don't want to be failures. We'd rather not be the Judas in the group. True. We'd rather not be the anchor, the dead weight, the weak link. Honestly, we'd rather be Peter, James, and John, closer in intimacy with Jesus than the ones who were farther away. And that's valid. Why? Because as Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5:9, we have as our ambition, whether at home or absent, to what? To be pleasing to him. Whether we're in the body or with the Lord, we want to be pleasing to the Lord. That is the single ambition that drives us, or should drive us. And when that is our aim, we pursue excellence. We pursue greatness. Nothing wrong with that. But there is something wrong, very wrong, with the disciples' obsession with greatness. What was it? Verse 33, When they came to Capernaum and he was in the house, he began to question them, "What were you discussing on the way?" And they kept silent because on the way they had discussed with each other which of them was the greatest. Obviously, Mark here wants us to see the jarring contrast between Jesus' humility and the disciples' obsession with distinction and recognition. And really, it's embarrassing, honestly. He has just explained to them that he must be rejected and killed, and they are arguing among themselves about which of them is the greatest. In fact, it's ironic. They didn't understand his statement in verse 31, and they were afraid to ask him. And so you might expect that on the way to Capernaum, that's what they're talking about, right? That's what they're discussing. What do you think he meant by that? Be delivered into the hands of men, be killed and rise again. What does that mean? But no, they're not talking about that. Instead, they're talking about themselves and their relative rank in relation to Jesus and each other. Which of them is greatest? Can you imagine how disparaging that must have been to Jesus? And their silence in verse 34, when he asked what they were talking about, they kept silent, shows their embarrassment, right? Their shame, their guilt. In fact, it's interesting, Mark uses that phrase, "but they kept silent." It's the same phrase he used back in chapter 3, verse 4, when Jesus had healed a man with a withered hand on the Sabbath in the synagogue, and knowing that the scribes and Pharisees were watching him, wanting to trap him and condemn him, he turned and said to them, "Is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath?" But they kept silent, it says. Same exact phrase as here. And so Mark's point is to show that the disciples are right where the Pharisees are. They're still making these shameful statements. They still have these shameful, disheartening attitudes. They're both guilty of unbelief and misunderstanding and hardness of heart. But what a contrast between Jesus and them. The humility, the selfless servanthood of Jesus, and the petty jockeying for position among them. By the way, a similar thing happens each time Jesus talks about the cross. There's actually three passion predictions in Mark, three times where Jesus explains to them what's about to happen to him. And in each case, it's the same basic message of his impending rejection and suffering and death. And in each case, it provokes the same discussion. In Mark 8, 9, and 10, the sobering news of what's about to happen to him is immediately followed by the disciples arguing among themselves about positions of status and prestige. Amazing, right? He talks of giving and surrendering his life, and all they can think about is finding and fulfilling theirs. Pretty sad. And I'm sure the silence must have been awkward when Jesus asked, "Hey, what were y'all talking about?" And as I say, this wasn't the only time. Turn a page over to Mark 10. Verse 32 says, "They were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking on ahead of them, and they were amazed, and those who followed were fearful. And again, he took the 12 aside and began to tell them what was going to happen to him, saying, 'Behold, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles. They will mock him and spit on him and scourge him and kill him, and 3 days later he will rise again.' James and John, the two sons of Zebedee, came up to him saying, 'Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you.'" And he said, all right, what do you want me to do for you? They said, grant that we may sit one on your right and one on your left in your glory. And Jesus said, you don't know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink or be baptized with the baptism with which I'm baptized? They said, oh, yeah, we're able. And Jesus said, the cup that I drink, you shall drink and you shall be baptized. But to sit on my right or on my left, this is not mine to give, but for those for whom it has been prepared. And then notice verse 41, hearing all this, the ten began to feel indignant with James and John. So this is, what do you do with this bunch? We're on the way to Jerusalem. Jesus is telling them what's about to happen. They pull him aside. Hey, Jesus, come here. Will you do something for us? Then the other ten find out what they're secretly talking about, and they get mad and jealous. Unbelievable. Just absolutely unbelievable, the audacity of James and John, and then the jealousy of the others. It gets worse. Look at Matthew chapter 20. In Matthew chapter 20, verse 17, it says, as Jesus was about to go up to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside by themselves, and on the way he said to them, behold, we're going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered up to the chief priests. Same thing, right? Verse 20, then the mother of the sons of Zebedee came to Jesus with her sons, bowing down and making a request of him. And he said to her, what do you wish? She said, command that in your kingdom these two sons of mine may sit on your right and on your left, and so on. Can you believe that? Really, guys? Send your mother? Just outrageous. Outrageous. And this little request, this little squabble, continued all the way to the very end. Look at Luke chapter 22. Luke chapter 22. You think sending their mother was bad? Luke chapter 22, verses 20 and 21, they're observing, this is in the upper room, and they're observing Passover. And in verse 21, Jesus reveals, but behold, the hand of the one betraying me is with mine on the table, for indeed the Son of Man is going, as it has been determined, but woe to that man by whom he is betrayed. And they began to discuss among themselves which of them it might be who was going to do this thing. So far, so good, right? But notice verse 24. Something happened in the white space between verse 23 and 24. Verse 24, and there also arose a dispute among them as to what? Which of them was regarded to be greatest? How do you do that? How do you go in a conversation in the upper room at the Passover table with Jesus from, really? One of us is going to betray you? To, which one of us is greatest? It's inconceivable, isn't it? That they could even, in what flow of thought led from that to that? You say, where did this preoccupation with greatness come from? Obviously, it comes naturally, right? It comes from our own sinful nature, our pride, our selfish ambition, our ego, our desire for exaltation. But their preoccupation with rank and standing was also not out of character with what we know of Judaism in general. Just like our culture is obsessed with it, so is theirs. We know for a fact, rabbinic writings frequently comment on the seating order in paradise. They argue that the truly righteous, the truly just, will sit nearer to the throne of God than even the angels, for example. But there was even a protocol or a sort of a pecking order for seating at worship services, at meals, at banquets. You see references to that in some of the parables Jesus teaches, places of honor that were reserved for those who ranked higher. And all of that, they believed, was both symbolic of and preparatory for the world to come. In the Qumran community, there was a document called the Rule of the Community, and it prescribed the proper order of procession in entering corporate gatherings. First priests, then Levites, and then, in the third place, all the people shall enter, one after another, in thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens, so that all the children of Israel may know their standing in God's community, in conformity with the eternal plan, and no one shall move down from his rank or move up from the place of his lot. I mean, that was Jewish culture, and the disciples were steeped in Jewish culture. They drank the Kool-Aid of their Jewish culture, where everyone was to know where they stood in the community. And so they naturally then transported all of that into their relationships with Jesus and with each other, constantly preoccupied with rank, position, importance, placement, order. And to be fair, their associations of Jesus and his kingdom with positions of honor, positions of privilege for them, was not entirely inaccurate. They knew that when the Son of Man came in his kingdom, there would be positions of rank and rule and responsibility for them. In Luke 22:28, he would say to them, "You are those who have stood by me in my trials, and just as my Father has granted me a kingdom, I grant you that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom, and you will sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel." So, to be fair, to try to maybe empathize with what's going on in their thinking, that maybe is why each of these passion predictions always tended to prompt this kind of a conversation. But notice how Jesus responds to them. Like a teacher, right? Like a disciple maker. Verse 35. Sitting down, he called the 12 and said to them, "If anyone wants to be first, he shall be last of all and servant of all." And there you see the paradox of greatness, right? The paradox of greatness. You want to be great? You want to be first? You want to be top gun? You want to be lead guy? I'll tell you what to be. Be last of all and servant of all. Which just shatters their perception, right? Just explodes their fantasy of being prominent, being famous, being first. No, to be first, you have to be willing to be last. To be greatest of all, you have to become the slave of all, the servant of all. And when you think about this, this really is maybe the most radical and revolutionary thing about Christianity. You want to talk about discipleship or discipleship curriculum? Stick this lesson in there. Forget about sitting around in a circle talking theology. Forget about eschatology and pneumatology, ecclesia. Forget about covenantalism versus dispensationalism. We think doctrine is hard. Doctrine is easy compared to this. You want to disciple somebody? Teach them to be humble. Model it for them. Teach them to serve. Teach them to be last and least and lowest. This is the hardest thing to learn. Anybody can learn Greek. Anybody can learn even Hebrew. That's not hard. What's hard and what few people really ever learn is how to be last, how to be least, how to be servant of all. And yet, that is the fundamental lesson in discipleship, second only to the gospel. And notice, please, Jesus doesn't exactly renounce prominence or renounce greatness. He redefines it. True greatness is not being first in rank or position. True greatness is being first in service to others. The word for servant there is diakonos. It's just a basic, ordinary Greek word for serving. Waiting tables is the picture. Just common, menial, simple, ordinary, routine labor. Anyone can do it. Everyone can be great by this standard. That's the point. It's just serving. And it refers to personal devotion in that service as opposed to service rendered as a slave or for hire. Out of devotion and desire, not just serving out of duty. It's a radical concept in Jesus' day. The Greek world generally considered service demeaning, insulting, undignified. Plato said, "How can a man be happy when he has to serve someone?" And his attitude would be typical of that time. Yet Jesus gave it a whole new depth and significance, didn't he? The kind of servant that he came to be, giving himself up for us. And that's what serving really is. Giving. Giving of yourself. Giving up yourself in service, in ministry to others. Among the Jews, especially the scribes and the rabbis, this question was discussed frequently. Who is the greatest in the kingdom of God? And some would say, well, it's the just. It's the righteous. Psalm 11:7. The Lord is righteous. He loves righteousness. The upright will behold his face. Others ranked knowledge of the Torah, performance of good deeds. They would put that person in first place. Some thought teachers were the greatest because of their role in instructing and leading others. Many people thought martyrs. Surely those who are martyred are the greatest in the kingdom. Jesus defines it in terms that are both familiar and attainable to every true believer. Greatness is not reserved for the gifted or the privileged few, but for any and every humble soul who is willing to occupy himself or herself in the simple, mundane, routine task of serving others. And Jesus was determined that his disciples learn to do that. In Mark 10 again, verses 42 and following, we stopped reading it, verse 41, but in verse 42 then, he calls them to himself and says, "You know that those who are recognized as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them. But it is not this way among you. But whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you shall be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and give his life a ransom for many." What a lesson. Three lessons, actually. First, that power struggles and power structures are out. That's the way the world works. That's not how the church works. Not so among you, he says. Forget about that. Positions of honor. Strive to be the best servant. Second, being great means being servant. It's not be a servant so that you can become great. It's not a stepping stone to greatness. It is greatness. The greatest of all is the servant of all. That's what he's saying. Leon Morris was right when he says, Jesus is not saying that if his followers wish to rise to great heights in the church, they must first prove themselves in a lowly place. No, he's saying that faithful service in a lowly place is itself true greatness. It's not a stepping stone. It's the definition of greatness. Third, that he's the model for it. Whoever wishes to be first among you shall be your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. So the point is clear, right? If even the Son of Man didn't come to be served, but to serve, who do you think you are? Who do I think I am? I walk in a room and I expect to be served? I walk in the church and I expect to be served. I walk in my house and I expect to be served. No. We should never think that. We should never think that somebody else ought to be serving me. We should always think I'm here to serve, not be served. And that's a challenge, isn't it? A, because it just goes against our selfish bent, but it also goes against our culture, even our contemporary church culture that is so obviously selfish and self-centered, so much so that the churches market themselves with that in mind. How can we appeal to these self-centered people? People pick churches based on the services that a church offers them. And all churches are competing for that same market of people who are church shopping. What does that tell you? It tells you that countless disciples still have not learned lesson two. Look again at Luke 22. Something here I want you to see. Whoops, wrong way. Luke 22. Again, verse 24, there arose this dispute among them. And so this becomes another opportunity for Jesus to teach on this yet again. And here he is very near the end. Another lesson on leadership. Verse 25, he said to them, the kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who have authority over them are called benefactors. He says, look, that's the way of the world. That's how the world works. Kings and rulers of the Gentile nations, pagans, operate the way you guys are talking about. Heathen kings lord it over their subjects, exercising authority as superiors over inferiors, parading around in their pomp and circumstance, imposing enormous taxation, mercilessly abusing their authority, and then have the audacity to demand humble service and demand submission and reverence and worship. They love to be called benefactor. What is that? That's a title that was actually found on numerous inscriptions from the time. Caesar Augustus was hailed on his birthday for his many benefactions. This is the kind of thing people clamored for. They wanted this kind of honor from people, although it was forced. And all the pagan rulers were like that. The Ptolemies, the Herods, the Caesars were all notorious for their greed, their malice, their ruthless tyranny. And the disciples know that. They've lived that. And Jesus says, you guys are acting just like that. And he says, verse 26, it is not this way. It is not to be this way among you. But the one who is the greatest among you must become like the youngest, and the leader like the servant. He says, you want to know what leadership is? Leadership is serving. That's all. Leadership is service. If you want to be the greatest of all, be the servant of all. Greatness is not about positions. It's not about titles. It's not about power and control. It's not about you lording your authority over other people. Greatness is about assuming the role of a servant and laying down your life in service to others and having no regard for yourself or for your own honor. And who's the ultimate example of that but Christ himself? And so that's the illustration he gives, verse 27. For who is greater, the one who reclines at the table or the one who serves? Is it not the one who reclines at the table? But I am among you as one who serves. And of course, we see that ultimately in his death, don't we? His willingness to lay down his life for his friends. Not merely to live, but to die for us. That's the ultimate sacrificial, costly service. But here's the thing. That's not an example for us to follow. Not really, because Jesus doesn't call us to die for others. And so the example he gives is in John 13. Look at this with me. John 13, again, in the upper room, the Lord's Supper, that whole scene. But how it begins as they even enter that upper room is just absolutely amazing. John 13, before the feast of the Passover, Jesus, knowing that his hour had come, that he would depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. During supper, the devil having already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands and that he had come forth from God and was going back to God, got up from supper, laid aside his garments, and taking a towel, girded himself. Then he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. See what John's doing there, right? He's building up this scene. It's unimaginable. Jesus, knowing, did what? Yep. And so he came to Simon Peter, and Simon got it. He's like, Lord, no. Oh, not washing my feet. Well, if I don't wash your feet, then you have no part of me. Well, then wash all of me. Well, I don't need to wash all of you. You're already clean. Picture there, I think, of salvation. You're already saved, but we all need our feet washed from time to time. We all continue to sin and need to be cleansed. Verse 12, so when he had washed their feet and taken his garments and reclined at the table again, he said to them, do you know what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you're right, I am. If I then, the Lord and the teacher, washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I gave you an example that you also should do as I did to you. A slave is not greater than his master, nor is one who is sent greater than the one who sent him. If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. I gave you an example. There's the example. You want an example of serving? There it is. You enter a room and do the thing nobody else is willing to do. That's what he did. You enter the room and you see the obvious thing, and everybody else is looking around like, who's going to do that? Not me. Notice he didn't institute an ordinance, wash feet. He established an example. Serve one another like that. Think like a servant. Do the job nobody else thinks to do. Do the thing everybody else expects somebody else to do. You've all heard that one, right? The four body brothers. Everybody, somebody, nobody, anybody. There was an important job to be done, and everybody was sure that somebody would do it. Anybody could have done it, but nobody did it. Somebody got angry about that because it was everybody's job. Everybody thought anybody could do it, but nobody realized that everybody wouldn't do it. It ended up that everybody blamed somebody when nobody did what anybody could have done. That's the disciples in the upper room. And that's, frankly, the saints in the church half the time. Everybody thought somebody would do it. Anybody could have done it. Guess who did it? Nobody. So Jesus gave you an example. The slave is not greater than his master. If he washed your feet, surely you ought also to wash one another's feet. And can you imagine? This is the last night. This is it. This is the last thing. And we talk about, you know, the Passover and how that was transformed into the Lord's Supper, and that was the thing that came out of this night. You know what I think came out of this night? A memorable impression they never got over. They never forgot. Can you imagine? Peter, his response was right on. What are you doing, Lord, washing my feet? In fact, we know Peter learned the lesson because in 1 Peter 5, what does he say? Elders, shepherd the flock of God among you, not lording it over those, but proving to be examples. And all of you, what does he say? Clothe yourselves with humility. Put on the apron of a servant. Grab the towel and a bucket of water and wash something. Clean something. Let me give you a quick overview on serving. There are seven things. Number one, serve. Romans 12:11. Not lagging behind in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. Two, serve faithfully. 1 Corinthians 4:2. What is required of stewards and servants but to be trustworthy, to be faithful? Three, serve with gladness. Psalm 100:2. Serve as an act of worship. Four, serve out of love, Galatians 5:13. Through love, serve one another. Five, serve by God's strength, 1 Peter 4:11. Whoever serves, let him do so as by the strength which God supplies. Six, serve in newness of the Spirit, Romans 7:6. Not in oldness of the letter. What does that mean? In the joy of life in the Spirit, not out of sheer obligation to duty. And then seven, serve as if serving Christ. Colossians 3:24 talks about that. Even when you're at work, think of it as serving the Lord. It is the Lord Christ whom you serve. So the preoccupation, the paradox. Thirdly, the practice of greatness. Go back, Mark 9. Look at this, verse 36, taking a child, he set him before them, and taking him in his arms, said to them, whoever receives one child like this in my name receives me, and whoever receives me does not just receive me, but receives him who sent me. This is really amazing. Who is great in the kingdom? That's what they want to know, right? Who's the greatest? I'll tell you who's the greatest. Whoever receives one child like this in my name. Notice carefully what he says there. He doesn't set the child before them and say, you want to be great? Be like this child. Not this time. That's not what he says. He's not saying, be like children, humble yourself, and be childlike in your humility. Here he's saying, be like Christ who receives them. Who welcomes them, who welcomes children like this. You want to test your greatness? How are you at receiving children? You say, why children? Well, because as opposed to our day when children are spoiled, rotten, and overindulged and the center of attention, in those days, children were the lowest of the low. They were nothing. They were insignificant. They contributed nothing. They had little value. They were considered, even among Jews in Judaism, as really marginal, auxiliary to society. Just kind of the, you know, not to be seen, not to be heard, just nobodies. And that wasn't just the Roman or Gentile attitude, but even Jewish one. Irrelevant, marginal. So they illustrate the very least, the very last, the very lowest. And so the point here is the child is not being used as an example of humility, but as an example of the little and insignificant ones whom followers of Jesus are to receive and welcome. Whoever receives one like this receives me. How we treat those whom the world views as insignificant. In fact, how we treat those who are viewed by the world as the very least significant people is how we treat Christ, is how we treat God. You want to be great? It's attainable, but you have to practice. Are you willing to practice greatness? How are you at welcoming and receiving into your arms, into your circle, into your life, into your care, into your home, into your love, those who are least and lowest and have absolutely nothing to give back to you in return? That's the issue. It's not any more complicated than that. It's doable. But that's what greatness is. That's what it would look like. And is that not what Jesus has done? He's the greatest. And what has He done but receive us and welcome us into His arms who have nothing to offer Him? So you want to be great? Here's the deal. Stop trying to impress people and find someone to serve. Find someone nobody cares about and care for them. Do the thing nobody else is willing to do. Stop looking around like, where's our waiter? Why haven't they served me yet? And settle in your own mind once and for all. I am not here to be served, but to serve. Father, thank you for this lesson tonight. We have to confess it's easier to just memorize verses. It's easier, it's more fun to just discuss theology, go to Bible studies, and measure our greatness by how much we know. Not so easy to practice true greatness. Don't give up on us, Father. Keep discipling us. Keep humbling us. Give us the mind of Christ. Make us servants. Teach us. Thank you for His example. May our servant attitude and actions start even right here with each of us serving one another, seeing the things that are needed and just taking the initiative to do it, looking for people who need help, need attention, need care, need affection, and giving it, receiving them, opening our arms to them. Thank you for this. Help us to practice this, to truly become great in this sense. Thank you for all the people in this church who are great in this sense. They do this. This is their practice. This is their life, constantly receiving little ones, not just children, but those who are least, those who are helpless. And just thank you for that and in them. Thank you for how that magnifies Christ and manifests His grace in our lives. May we continue to grow in this area for His honor and glory. Amen. All right, thank you. Supper is served, I think.